You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 316. She was only 16. We are back on the Punk News Podcast, the Motown Podcast. She was only 16 and I was too young to fall in love. And speaking of falling in love, we've got a man that's fallen in love once, at least once. Dynamite Adam White. Dynamite Adam White, describe what it is like to fall in love.
With a woman or with like the sea?
The sea. What is that? To fall in love with the sea.
The sea. All right. Now, I grew up in Ontario, so I don't really know anything about the sea. But I have to presume, John, that it is both cold and salty.
Just like my love life. Anyway, here we are. We are also here with Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, love, does it exist, or is it merely a chemical reaction designed to propagate one species?
Wow. Well, now my world's been turned upside down. Probably.
He's like, love doesn't exist.
That science-y one sounded pretty good, I'm not gonna lie.
Well, there you go, have it. Ricky taking the nihilist or pragmatic stance that love does not exist, but it is merely an evolutionary mechanism to propagate the species and preserves one's genes for further distribution along the genetic line. Anyways, this is Features Editor John Gentile. We have got a packed news week this week. A lot of stuff went down. But as always, you can reach... let's do mail first, and then we'll touch some other things. Oh, actually, before we do mail, I want to just touch on this briefly. Adam and Ricky, in the past, we would change our intro music every 100 episodes. We had different music from 0 to 100, and then from 100 to 200, we had like... the sandwiches or something, and then from 200 to 300 we had the Nightbirds. That's been my favorite by far. I love the Nightbirds intro music, especially when Brian Gorsanger says boat trash. It sounds like he's saying podcast. So I love our current intro, and in that it's very punk rock. It's very, but it's got a swing to it. It's got real energy to it. It's not too hard, but it's hard. However, I mean, should we change our intro music for 300 or 400? Is it time to change our intro music? Or should we just stay with the Nightbirds forever? Are people tired of the intro? Should we do a new intro? Because frankly, it'll be a tough act to follow the current Nightbirds intro music. But then again, maybe it is time for a change.
I mean, why change something that's working? I really like it too. If we were to change it, I would hope that we at least look at other instrumentals by Nightbirds.
Really? None of the Nightbirds? Daring choice.
No, like the other ones by Nightbirds. I think that'd be just to see what else there is. That might work. I don't know.
There are not a lot of punk rock bands that will like bust out an instrumental anymore. So we'd be pretty slim pickings otherwise to find something that fits that vibe. You know what? I don't know if it's an 100 episodes thing. I feel that the theme song changes sort of went with a little bit of the, a little bit of like the hosting transitions over time. And that I want to say that like that Nightbirds to me is more the John Gentile era, the Ricky Frankel era of the Punk News Podcast. Whereas the song that with the that Scotty Sandwich put together was really more of the Rich Verducci, Chris Brian Moran. Yancey, Chris Moran realm of things. So I don't feel we need to change it because it's 100 and that, and I like it. But I guess me as the one constant between those two eras decides to fire the two of you, then I'll get a new song.
Well, it looks like I'm on the chopping block as usual. Speaking of being on the chopping block, we got some mail. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Jason. I think he's down in Texas. I'm glad Jason wrote in because he hasn't written in about a year. I was worried that he stopped listening. We like Jason. He was on Punk's Points at least once, and he won some records. This is what Jason said. John, when you talk about Bananarama, you have to mention the Karate Kid. So that's from Jason. I did not know Bananarama was in the Karate Kid, but I'll take Jason's word and I will rewatch Karate Kid to look out for Bananarama. This is from Kier. Kier, last week we were talking about how Adam might not hate millennials, and we don't really hate millennials. We like a lot of millennials, but I do was actually Adam White's position, which I second. Adam White likes bussing on millennials because he finds the exercise interesting. Is that correct, Adam White?
God, I don't even know. I don't know like what psychosis drives me towards that. I guess it's that I'm considered one of them, but I didn't choose to do that.
I don't think we are millennials.
I'm going to fight them.
There you go. Adam White fighting against his own people. Much like I'm trying to think of a historical equivalent. Benedict Arnold, if you will. Kier wrote in and he said, all generations are garbage. Best wishes from Kier.
That's really...
That was pretty good.
And this is
that should be the tagline for this show, really.
I think it's all generations are garbage.
Yeah.
This is from Richard out in the UK, our friend Richard out in the UK. And he says, here's a question I'd like to throw out to you and the listeners. What is the best way to purchase your favorite band's music? It seems every time I hear a great band I want to support, I can't make up my mind which way I want to do it. CDs, Bandcamp, iTunes, or vinyl. Which then invariably leads me to do nothing, as there are various ways you can end up streaming for free, even without subscribing to Spotify. Do bands make more money off hard copies or the digital downloads? My heart always says vinyl, but my wallet sure does prefer Bandcamp downloads. Which would you guys and the listeners consider the best option to support the bands? Richard.
You know, I saw someone the other day that tweeted out, and this might have just been a joke, but they tweeted something to the effect of, you know, I love Bandcamp, but if someone opts to pay $1 for the song that I've just sold them, and then Bandcamp charges me $1 on the service fee for selling the song, then I feel a little, you know, a little let down. So I don't actually know what the fees are associated with selling digital music from Bandcamp. But at some point it, I guess, is not incredibly lucrative. I struggle with this as well, and really for the same reason as Richard, in that I would prefer to have vinyl. I love vinyl, but I can't accumulate like massive Ricky Frankel Instagram versions, you know, levels of vinyl, because I don't think I have that much money. So I'm always stuck about what to do there myself, and I probably will do the same de facto thing where I'll have something that I'm maybe not in urgent need of, but I kind of like, and I'll end up, you know, I'll stream it a bunch, and in my brain I've done something, but as far as the financial levers, none of them have actually been pulled in a meaningful way that gets the band any money. So yeah, that's tough. What my gut would tell me would be to buy something physical from them. And that would probably be the best scenario. I really feel that like so many of these bands, especially of the ones of the levels that we're talking about, are making more money when you're buying a t-shirt than anything else these days. So that tends to be my de facto thing. I know if I can get out to see a band live, and that's not always an option for everyone, depending on where you are and depending on where the band is touring, I feel like I can do right by them then, because I can actually go buy something and give them money where I know there's probably like as few, you know, eels in between me and them that are like taking a cut. So if I go to their merch guy and I give them, you know, $20 or $30, and they give me some shit that they had made for, you know, $5 or $10 their cost, then all right, I've given them some money. I walk away with something physical, so I feel like I haven't just like thrown money out into the internet ether. And then that's best for everyone. I know that doesn't quite work everywhere, and it's tough in that case, because then you know you have to make some sort of call. I just did this the other day. Sonic Avenues is a great punk band out of Montreal. I mean I own the record, but I want to support those guys. I like them, so it was like, well, I'm gonna go buy a t-shirt from them on Bandcamp, because that seems like a thing that I can do that's useful. So yeah, I don't know. What about you guys? I mean, I feel that you guys are somewhat spoiled in this, and that you have greater access to product than I assume that Richard in the UK does, as well as me.
I mean, for me, I've said this before. You know, I think the whole vinyl with the free download is the best bang for your buck. It's not necessarily the cheapest. I'll grant you. And even I, believe it or not, even I've slowed down on vinyl a little bit, just because I was getting the stuff that had come out before I started collecting. I watched some like Vice talk. It was called either the cost of living or something like that. And it was like a panel discussion about the music industry for one of the episodes. And it actually turns out that Bandcamp takes less of a commission, I think, than iTunes. So the band gets more through Bandcamp, and also you can choose what kind of file you want from them, and you can stream it too. I'm sure it doesn't hurt to buy merch. It definitely doesn't hurt to buy merch too. Sometimes I do, if I'm at a show and I don't really necessarily see something I want, but they have like a tip jar out, at the merch booth, I'll throw them $5 or 10 or whatever I'm feeling like that day, just to keep them going if they put on a really, really great show.
You got to be careful with that tip jar though, because sometimes the tip jar is the merch guy's tip jar. You know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, I do that. I agree. But especially I think the last time I did it was with when I saw Direct Hit and Pairs out in Pomona, and I know those guys are putting it all towards getting to the next show. So,
because Ricky, there's a band that you and I like that I won't necessarily mention, and they used to have a merch guy. He was like Norwegian or something, or Swedish, and he was this tall, skinny guy. You could just definitely tell the guy was a little sketchy, and he would like demand tips from people.
Really?
And meanwhile, the tips were for him. You know what I mean? It's like you're the merch guy. You're already getting paid. You don't get tips. You know. So it was funny for me. I always want physical over digital. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. I always want the option that has the most amount of music on it. So if the CD has more tracks than the vinyl, I want the CD. Yeah. If the digital has more tracks than the CD, I'll get the CD, but I might also try to get the bonus tracks on the digital. So the first thing I want is physical. After physical, I want the thing that has the most amount of tracks on it. If I could only pick between digital, CD, record and cassette, I'm picking CD every time. However, for certain bands, I want CD. For certain bands, I want vinyl. For like heavy metal bands, well, like thrash bands, I want CD. But for like stoner metal bands like Sleep, I want vinyl just because I listen to it in a different way. Like I'll listen to thrash in my car, but Sleep, I'll probably listen on my turntable while I'm doing something. You know, reggae, if I have to pick, I'll take vinyl. But if the reggae CD has bonus tracks and it's remastered, I want the CD over the vinyl. I never want digital unless it's my only option. I always want a physical product. If my only option is digital or cassette, which is more and more common these days, I'm taking cassette. But I also might get the digital too if it's cheap. In that case, they're usually both pretty cheap. What pays the band the most? I think digital pays the band the most because that's pure profit almost, minus whatever digital overhead there is. Because with records, the profit margin, unless they're – see, punk fans, they want everything to be super duper cheap. And so punk bands might sell records for $12, but it costs them like $7 or $8 to make them. So they only make $4, where CDs only cost about $1.50 to make, and they sell for $10, $12. And so there's more money that way. Though more and more punk bands are raising the price of their vinyl records, which I'm okay with. Now vinyl records are like $15 or $20. So the band probably does make some money that way. But if your sole interest is supporting the band, you're probably best off buying digital and then buying merch when they're on tour. But if you want to support the band to some degree, I would say just buy physical and the band directly from the band at the show, and they're making money that way. Bands tend to make less money if you buy from the label or from a distributor. So buying from the band directly always gets them the maximum amount of cash. And so if I have to pick, I'm picking CD because I love CDs still.
Yeah, and make sure that you qualify digital. But by digital, we don't mean streaming. We mean
actually
bought the MP3s from someone, because streaming, they make something, but it's, you know, a fraction of a penny.
Yeah, streaming is almost negligible. I know Scotty Tank Crimes says that they make some money, but not. I don't think it's that much, really. So, you know, streaming is cool, but it's,
yeah,
I also think that we haven't mentioned the one other option here is that you could just like offer people hand jobs. That's a way to pay.
If you really like the band, though.
It's not about you. It's about them.
Adam White getting quite randy on this week's podcast. Speaking of randy things, it's Ramones week at Punk News. By the time you hear this, I think Ramones week will be over. We're probably going to be doing a Ramones dedicated podcast, so we'll just briefly mention it. Adam White, Ramones week, how's it treating you? Are you excited for Ramones week? And are you as stymied as I am that we actually got complaints that we're doing Ramones week? Like, people didn't want us to do Ramones week.
I didn't actually see the complaints. Give me the crib notes of what the complaints are.
Yeah, some guys, like, Ramones week and Clash week, that's bullshit, is what some guy said. You know?
Oh, well, how could I argue with that, right? I mean, if the dude on the internet says it's bullshit, I guess that we're just going to have to own that.
Let's briefly discuss my strategy. For Clash week, I wanted to have a very definitive week, and that we covered all the important Clash albums and all the important singles. And I think we did an excellent job on that. Our writers did a very good job. And basically, we covered the entire Clash discography from what I would call an objective point of view. For Ramones week, there's way more Ramones releases than our Clash releases, and so I basically said, let's do this more subjective, and you can write about whatever you want from a more personal perspective, and also from a more, I guess, askew perspective. Like, our reviews this week aren't, this is why this record is important, more like, this is what this says about the band at this point in time, this is what this says about this solo artist, either Joey or Dee Dee, stuff like that. Do you guys have an opinion on the objective, definitive review, as opposed to, I guess, the more academic, incisive style review coverage of the Ramones?
I think
we're both talking at the same time. Rick, you want to fight?
Go ahead, Adam.
No, I was going to fight you. All right. So in my head, the Ramones, especially given the Punk News editorial's relationship with the Ramones, is entirely different than our relationship with the Clash, in that it seems like a lot of people that help put Punk News together have a serious Clash fixation, and we sort of always have historically. So for us to approach the Clash, you know, we want to be more comprehensive, and we want to take the approach that we did then. The Ramones gets everyone's love, but there's a bigger discography, and it's not all necessarily revered, and there's way more land to cover.
And it's not as clean as the Clash arc too.
No, it's not as tight a narrative. Like, it goes on for way, way longer than the Clash did. I think that makes it more interesting in one perspective, in that I feel like there's a lot of stuff you could talk about with regards to the Ramones that the casual observer will not have encountered. Punk kid on the internet today, they're probably aware of, you know, the relationship between, like, you know, London Calling and the first Clash record and Combat Rock. You know, they have less idea of where to play something like, say, like Acid Eaters in the Ramones universe, right? So it to me is something that's actually, it needs that revisiting, especially now, given that we're 40 years and everything, so it's an opportune time to do it. But yeah, I don't know what my point was in that. Ricky, actually make a point.
I like these weeks sparingly, but these also give us a reason to go back through the band's discography and see what reviews we're missing. And for example, I reviewed CJ Ramone's first album, which we never had a review of. And also it gives us a chance to find like the weird stuff. Like, I have my review of just like the Bonzo Goes to Bitburg EP coming out. And that also wasn't reviewed. So I think, especially since it's a 40-year review, it's a good way to see, to kind of go back and find all the missing stuff that we don't have on the site yet. Yeah, but I have no problem with this. I think that the Ramones deserve it. It's not like we're doing a band that's like just starting right now. I think that would be weird.
Or that Screwdriver week that John keeps trying to make happen.
The first record is good, and the second.
Yeah, it's not like we're doing Metallica week or something. We're doing, you know, a seminal punk band, and what happened after when they were done. So And also, the, I mean, these are these guys were hugely influential, so why not?
This is completely off topic, but Adam White mentioned Screwdriver. I'm mystified by Screwdriver because the main Screwdriver, is a guy called Ian Stewart. Everyone knows that Screwdriver was racist. Before Ian Stewart was in Screwdriver, he was in a Rolling Stones cover band. And I find that so weird because the Rolling Stones music is black American music. Like, how do you go from black American music to hating black people? You know what I mean? Like,
you're asking why aren't these racists rational?
I am asking that, and I always find it amusing that Ian Stewart is also the name of the Rolling Stones' long-term piano player. But and that's the name of this guy in Screwdriver, but they're different guys. Anyways, that's Screwdriver. Listen, we're going to play a song. We're not going to play you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love hearing your opinions, especially on Screwdriver. Although if you have certain opinions on Screwdriver, we might take it to task. We'll find out. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Let's play a song. We're not going to play a Ramones song because we're probably going to do a Ramones special. I don't know. Adam, what, you want to play a jam or you want me to play a jam?
Yeah, here. I'll play not a Ramones song. But it is a song that will be, you know, really heavily inspired by the Ramones. So let's see, what should I play here? We're going to play a song by the Hanson Brothers.
Oh,
which was the, if you remember the Hanson Brothers, this was a punk rock band that was the members of, Western Canadian punk legends, No Means No. And the No Means No guys decided that they were going to get together and record as a Ramones influenced band that was equally influenced by like the 1977 hockey movie Slapshot. So this is an equal mix of songs about like goon hockey and stuff that is Ramonesy. So let's see, what should I play here? I had a couple candidates that were in mind for this. I'm gonna annoyingly type on my computer.
Also, Hanson Brothers have that. Actually, they've got great parody album covers. They've got one that parodies Ramones, "Road to Ruin," and they've got another that parodies "Black Flags My War." But the Hanson Brothers album is called "My Game." My Game.
So actually, the song that I'm going to play you comes from "My Game," which came out in 2002. This is 110% by the Hanson Brothers, a Ramones inspired act for Ramones Week. So here we go. We'll be right back.
are back, and that was the Hanson Brothers off their Alternative Tentacles release, My Game. Great band. You should check them out. Let's talk about one of Ricky's favorite bands, even though we'll see if he denies if this is one of his favorite bands like he did last week with both Jeff Rosenstock and the Interrupters. Wow. Ricky, is this still one of your favorite bands?
They're on my – yeah, I mean, they're on my radar. They've never been like – fuck yeah.
I thought you were like insane about this band.
I think I like them a lot more than, you know, some of the bands you like that you mentioned, but you know, I think they're good. This story was a bit eye-opening though.
Okay, well, fair enough. Let's read the story. This was big news. This is one of our biggest stories we had all year. This kind of blew up the internet. Gloss. I guess I can call it a transactivist band. That's not offensive, right? If I call them a transactivist band.
Everything you say is offensive, John, but no, I think that works.
So anyway, apparently they were probably approached by Epitaph Records, that's Mr. Brett's label, to put out a record on Epitaph Records. So far, Gloss has put out one EP and one demo tape, I believe. The Epitaph offer was 20 grand up front, 20 grand advance, 30 grand in marketing, and they could use the marketing whatever the way they want it, which would include buying ads, I guess going on tour, buying a tour van like that. It was unclear if the offer was recuperable or not recuperable. That means, is that really a zero interest loan from the record label, or is it just a straight up gift, say, here you go, please put out a record with us? However, Gloss denied declined the offer. I'm going to read the whole thing. This is from Sadie Switchblade. That's the lead singer of Gloss. This is from her Instagram. For those who have been asking, Gloss will not be signing to Epitaph Records. It's hard to say no to a $20,000 advance and $30,000 to marketing our album. Marketing could include buying ourselves a new van, for example. But as Epitaph is distributed by Warner Music Group, we cannot ethically partner with them. I would be lying if I said that this isn't tempting or that it's not deeply validating to be pursued by the label that put out the bands that got me through high school, Rancid, Distillers, Oscar, etc. I spent those years with a frown on my face and headphones on my ears, walking the halls and holding onto the music for dear life. But we want Gloss to be a threat to entrenched models, at the very least to be exciting. We floated the idea of cutting a radical organization in the profit-sharing model if we were to sign with Epitaph. How cool would it be to make thousands of dollars for the homeless shelter here in Ollie, for AMP in San Jose, Black Lives Matters groups, disabled queers? But if we do the work of self-releasing an album, we will not only refuse to enrich the corporate music system, but also in the long run make more money. Gloss started casually in a basement and has grown to a level of popularity that feels overwhelming at times. Having our house in constant disarray with thousands of records strewn about is chaotic and becoming untenable. If we can come up with the startup money to rent a space and hire a couple of friends, we can use Total Negativity, our guitarist label, to support our scene without having to turn to an outside entity. When we get around to recording a full length, we'll probably be doing a first press of 20,000 copies. That's not a bedroom operation anymore. While signing to a label like Epitaph would be in many ways relieving, it would probably mean the death of the feeling that so many of you have told us means so much to you. We could never do that to all of you who have been so supportive and whose words have meant the world to us. What I'm trying to say is we don't have to jump into their world. We can create a new one. Thank you for being part of this feeling. It means so much to us.
Heart.
Yeah, there's a heart. I'm going to say heart.
Heart emoticon. I hate emoticons. I'm not a fan.
Actually, computer science hat, that's not an emoticon. That's a Unicode character. Anyways.
I can start this. I mean, when I saw this, I was more surprised about that they got offered than them rejecting it. I mean, I think that's pretty clear that if someone had said, like, do you think if they got offered, they would sign to this record label? I said, I would probably say no, probably for about all the reasons. I am a fan of Gloss. When I saw them, it was a killer show, and I think their new EP was great. I see a couple things wrong that I think I would have done differently if I put this statement out. One, 20,000 copies for a first pressing is an insane amount. That is a lot. I mean, there are record labels that we talk about that put out like 1 or 2,000.
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt you, Ricky. Just for instance, Jeff Rosenstock's last album, I think, sold 5,000 its first few months.
Just for reference. Yeah, so I mean, is that counting me or not?
No, that's agreeing with you that 20,000 is a lot, because 5,000 is pretty good for a band of Jeff Rosenstock size.
Yeah, and then I can't imagine Epitaph is real happy about this. I mean, if it...
Oh, I disagree, but go ahead. I'm sorry, Ricky, go ahead.
I wouldn't have put how much they were they offered us. I mean, that's just not that's not cool. At least I don't think so. You might have a different reasons being all right. But whenever you start getting into specifics of money, it's never a good idea, regardless if you're talking about any kind of business, really. But I mean, hey, they stuck to their principles. I think everyone was pretty okay with it. And then it seemed kind of split. Like, some were saying, "Oh my God, they're so stupid, they should have taken it," or "Good for them, they stuck with it." And you know, the comments in the Facebook story were even more brutal than the ones on the site. I hand it off to you, John.
Well, I'll let Adam respond.
I think this is an incredibly interesting, I don't know, turn of events. If not, because there's like four or five levels of this that I want to unravel. So if I go long on this, just someone shut me up. First, I mean, and this is just totally superficial read on this, from a level of tact, I wouldn't have mentioned the dollar values either. I agree with Ricky there. There's something about that feels a little bit self-aggrandizing, in that, you know, it's not simply that, you know, we want to bravely go our own way, but as we want to bravely go our own way and look at, look, we've just put like $50,000 into the spiritual bank, right?
50,000 like, punks points.
Yeah, right. Like I could have, and I actually largely agree with their entire statement and what they've done here. But there is, I don't know, it may have just been the way that I've been raised or something like that. But you don't talk about money like that.
That's sort of like not like a class, as in like class structure, but as in like, you know, kind of like just having class about it, you know. I guess.
Yeah, I know. So, but you know what?
I'm just saying, like, that's just kind of how it goes.
I'm gonna give that a pass. I think that because they've decided to talk about these numbers, well, the problem with that is that whereas they could have just said, you know, we were made a generous offer from Epitaph and we're going to turn it down, because they've actually put out the numbers, that's going to cause people to, I think, divert away from the interesting part of this and start to split hairs on some of the details of it, which is what I kind of want to do now, because I'm looking at it and asking exactly what John asked earlier, was, well, how much of that's recoupable? Because I don't think a lot of people realize this about the way that record labels work, especially people that have had no reason to discover that this is the way that record labels work, is that, you know, there's an advance in that, you know, it's here is some money and, you know, go do with what you will. But there's also an advance in that it is specifically that it is an advance on record sales. So if they're giving you $20,000, that means that the first $20,000 worth of records that you sell go back to the label to repay the $20,000 that they've loaned you. Now, I'm fudging up the math a little bit there, but that's essentially how that works. That's why it's called an advance in some cases. So it's money to go get on the road and to make things happen, but it's hardly a lottery win. It's not a big paycheck. It's, you know, it's money that you now owe someone, and you may not owe them it in the same way that, you know, you owe the bank money. I mean, your band could break up and fall apart, and, you know, contractually that might be able to get you out of this, but not if you're on Victory Records, but did I say that? I didn't say that. Don't sue me, Victory Records. But it's that's the case in a lot of places. So, you know, yes, a sizable amount of money basically allows you to grease the wheels to make things happen while your band has the momentum to make those things happen. And that's what I think people should be aware that they're choosing to turn down is they're choosing to turn down this amplification of what they're doing and something to expedite them, you know, making the next thing happen while the attention of the world is still on them. That's what they're turning down. They're not turning down like a bag of money that they can go do whatever they want with. So I think that's a point that you have to make, because while I don't know the details of their contract, of course, yeah, presumably it's a fairly normal kind of record contract, and it's, you know, it's an advance that they have to pay someone back. I could totally be wrong about that, but that's my read on it here. But getting past that and getting past the money thing, I totally support what they're doing here, and I support it from the standpoint of I appreciate the outlook that they've taken on it. If they would have made this about the evils of the Warner Music Group, of which I am not aware in particular, then I would have been less interested in this, I think, as a story. Now, I know that the Warner Music Group is a big multinational corporation, and I'm sure you could draw a little line graph that goes from like them to the Rand Corporation, and then you draw like three more lines and you're at like Lockheed Martin, and then you do two more lines and you're like the Assad government in Syria. Like, I'm sure that I'm sure someone can draw that graph and it's horrible. But whenever I that feels to me like a very like 90s kind of sellout read on the way that these businesses actually work. When in reality, if you're manufacturing and distributing stuff, records are not, probably at some point you can draw a line between you and some company that's doing a horrible thing somewhere to make it happen. Whether it's the fact that the record label that's distributing your records, or the distribution network for your record label, you know, you can draw some lines to something bad, or the fact that you're filling up your van with Shell gasoline that's come out of some, you know, totally destroyed village in Africa or whatever, right? There's horribleness all around. So I'm less interested in this from the ethics of the Warner Music Group. I'm more interested in this from really the optimistic outlook of them saying, look, like, we have momentum, but we've been able to get the momentum so far by doing this on our own. We could presumably do this on our own. And the last statement of their statement, I think, is very powerful here, where they said, we don't have to jump into their world. We can create a new one. And to me, that's the promise of where we are in music right now. Like, we have this internet. We have no barriers in the same way that we used to have barriers. You don't have to go Paola the radio guy to get your song heard by someone. There's, you know, you could come at this from a completely outside the box angle and make noise about your band and get people to know about them without you ever needing to necessarily play in the traditional record industry. And I don't mean that to say that that I want all these dinosaurs in the traditional record industry to go away. But what I mean by that is that, like, if you're the kind of band that it's sort of in your DNA to do that, like fucking do it. Cool. I'm good with that. Like, to me, honestly, it would feel weird if a band like Gloss that has been this like underground phenomenon is all of a sudden, you know, on Epitaph or any other label. Oh, not to speak ill of Epitaph.
I don't think that would be weird. But I'm going to approach it from a slightly different angle and then feed into Adam White's point. Is that I actually think Mr. Brett is to be commended for this. And for a while, I have not been. Well, actually, I've never been a huge fan of Epitaph Records, but I've really had. Not a beef, but I've thought less of Mr. Brett because he puts out like these Attila bands and these Falling in Reverse bands, and I don't have a problem with those bands existing at all. You know, those bands have very misogynistic lyrics, you know, stupid lyrics, violent lyrics, brainless lyrics. I don't have a problem with a band doing that at all. What I do have a problem with is Epitaph marketing those songs towards children, which they do, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds. I don't approve of that. And Mr. Brett always says, oh, I like every band on Epitaph. I don't believe for a minute that Mr. Brett is jamming to Falling in Reverse. I mean, maybe he is, but I don't believe it. However, he's clearly trying to sign other bands. He signed The Garden, which is one of my favorite bands. Now he's trying to sign Gloss. He's basically doing what I think is probably most commendable, in that he's giving listeners and fans a menu of options to choose from. If you want this nasty kind of music, you can have it. If you want this very political kind of music, you can have it. It's up to you to make your own decision instead of me force feeding you one type of music. I still don't approve of him, you know, selling Falling in Reverse to children. If he was selling it to adults, I'd say that's fine. But selling it to children, I got a little bit of an issue with. But I do think it's commendable for Mr. Brett to make, I mean, really spending a fair amount of cash on a fairly radical band. Although maybe they're not so radical anymore. It's tough for me to tell you the truth whether or not Gloss is that radical or just kind of radical. I'm losing perspective.
I'll tell you, if you go see them live, you'll see that it is a fairly. It's definitely it's a radically different show for sure.
No, I mean, I'm saying, are they radical?
Yeah. Oh, no,
are they like tubular?
Both, honestly.
No, are they awesome? No, I mean, are they a radical? Like, how far left are they really? I'm losing perspective with regards to that.
I can tell you how they started out their show. If you want,
how they started out their show.
What they do is, so they get on stage. At least this is when I saw them. They get on stage. They say, before we start, and I'm paraphrasing here, before we start, we want all the girls to come to the front. This is like for you. This is your show. And then we want all the guys to go to the back, which honestly doesn't end up that well by the end of their performance, because you have a lot of the guys are all moshing and making their way up to the front anyway later. But that's kind of how they start their band.
See, I exist in two or three different worlds. And so I really don't know how radical that kind of a statement is. Like if I was at a show, I mean, I don't agree with those kind of statements, but if I was at a show and a band said that, I wouldn't be surprised.
I wasn't surprised. I was just surprised. I mean, if someone had told me that before I walked in, I would have been like, that's very different. They're kind of, I guess in some ways they're definitely walking the walk instead of just, you know, singing the lyrics about gender politics.
I don't know how radical that really is these days. I really don't know. But with regards to not signing with, so anyway, I think Mr. Brett is to be commended, because he's diversifying his label and he's bringing in some pretty wild, far out bands, and I think that's cool. And so you can no longer accuse Mr. Brett of simply chasing the dollar. As a side note, The Clash signed to CBS for £100,000. What do you? I converted that from 1977 pounds to 2016 pounds, and then from pounds to dollars. What do you guys think that is in American dollars today?
That's got to be close to 500,000.
Adam, what do you think?
I'm not doing that math in my head. I'll go with Ricky.
700 to 1 million. Dollars, $700,000 to $1 million. And so that's really a statement on the music industry, in that bands used to sign for a mil off the bat, and now 50 G's, you know, with 30 G's on marketing is the number. But that's just the music industry. With regards to the band's choice, if it's purely a financial decision, I support them 100%. I think a band should take control of their finances as much as they can. So if it's purely a financial decision, I think it's a good idea what they're doing. If the decision is based on because Warner Brothers is evil, I think it's a little foolish, and here's why. Far-left bands have a notorious history of shooting themselves in the foot and basically being small simply so they don't compromise for anything. But the problem being is, even bands that think they aren't compromising for anything actually are compromising all the time. Adam White alluded to this, you know. They buy gas, you know. Who made the CDs? Where are the CDs they're using? Where do they come from? Whose clothes are they wearing? Who made those clothes? And I realize bands can do the best they can. However, it's my perspective in that pragmatic action beats idealism every day of the week. A good example is Chumbawamba. Chumbawamba signed to a major label. All the punks were like, you guys suck, you guys suck. And then Chumbawamba used that $1.5 million advance to really dramatically change people's lives who needed to, who really could have used the help. And I think that's nobler than just saying, oh, we're not going to conform to a system. I think helping people directly beats a statement every day of the week. That being said, you know, $50,000 is not going to change. I mean, $50,000 divided by five people, $10,000 after taxes, $6,000. $6,000 is not going to radically change anybody's life to a degree. It'll radically change some people's lives, but not like, you know, Chumbawamba's $1.5 million or whatever it was. So I don't agree with their decision if it was simply because of distribution by Warner. I think if they signed to Epitaph, they could do a lot more good because they'd have distribution channels, they'd have media channels, and they'd have tour packages, and they could get in front of an audience they wouldn't normally be in front of. But I respect – so I disagree with them on that ground, but I respect and I can see a certain validity to the action they're taking. So the difference is I'm more pragmatic and I guess they're more idealistic.
Just to sort of lightly counter that, I mean, they've been doing just fine since they've started without any money being put into marketing. They throw their stuff up on Bandcamp, and have you seen their Bandcamp pages? It's flooded with all of the thumbnails of all the people that bought them.
I'm not saying they're not doing well, but who's bigger, Against Me or Gloss?
Oh, Against Me. Yeah.
When did Against Me shoot up in popularity?
When
they signed to a major label. And so I think Gloss could hypothetically do the same thing, get on MTV, you know,
and
get
push
on
their message.
Rolling Stone. That's my point. Could they do that by themselves right now? Now more than ever is a time where they do have the possibility to do that, now more than ever. So that's why I respect their opinion, but I think I would go for the pragmatic, wider audience to – assuming there's no creative control under Mr. Brett, and I don't think Mr. Brett would have creative control under a project
like this. Wait, but what about the fact that they're on the same – does the fact that they're on the same label as like those other, you know, dumb bands that preach all basically the exact opposite of what this band preaches – Is that a weird contradiction, or is it just something? They're all separate.
It's actually one of the most noble virtues in punk rock. I would say is there is an audience out there that is getting a message that they disagree with, especially a young audience. It's, you know, it's okay to call women bitches. It's okay to hit women, like Attila has said in their lyrics, and even Falling on the Verse. So you get in front of that audience and you say, Attila is wrong. I am here to show you why Attila is wrong. Just like when the Beastie Boys used to play with Disturbed in front of a festival, the Beastie Boys didn't say because Disturb had that song Slap That Bitch Up. Was that, or maybe it was Limp Bizkit? It was some band had a song called like Slap That Bitch Up. And the Beastie Boys didn't like that. So where the punk reaction would be like, well, I'm going to pull out of that festival because I don't want to be associated with those guys. Instead, the Beastie Boys got up there and said, we think that's a lame song and we don't think you should have those kinds of lyrics. And I agree with the Beastie Boys' position.
The whole thing is, I think, a very healthy discussion that has all of a sudden cropped up, and that we don't seem to have these days. I mean, there was so much hand-wringing over bands signing to major labels or signing to big labels, you know, back in the 90s, back in the early 2000s, but like no one has these discussions anymore. And I don't know if it's just because there's generally no money in music at the moment, so it's not a big deal. And this is comparatively way less money and way less of a band label mismatch than any of the ones that we ever talked about. Like it's not Rancid signing to Sire. It's not, you know, Against Me signing to Sire. Was Rancid on Sire or was Rancid on Reprise? I don't know what Rancid signed to. Whenever Rancid signed to the major label, whatever the fuck that was, right? It's not, you know, any of those deals had to have been for way more money and way more of a ethical compromise than if Gloss signed Epitaph. So it's funny to put it into perspective and just to look at it compared to the things that everyone used to be up in arms about. Like this is the world these days as far as music and money goes. Like this is so teeny compared to what everyone was getting riled up about. Shit, John, it's not $1 million for the Clash.
Yeah. Well, actually, though, Adam, to go along with your point, when people cried when Rancid signed to a major, people cried when Green Day signed to a major, and you can say maybe their message was compromised, and you go back and forth with that, but they reached a lot of people, and they changed a lot of people's opinions of punk rock and certain ideas.
I'm going to say that when Rancid signed to a major, it was a dumb idea.
Oh, really?
let's think about Rancid here. This was late in the day Rancid. This was Rancid after Out Come the Wolves, after Life Won't Wait, after that cool 2000 record. This was old Rancid that no one gave a shit about, that for whatever reason signed to a major and started hanging out with like Kelly Osbourne. Like, it didn't make any sense at all.
Fair enough. I concede.
Green Day. I'll give you that. So I'm going to segue into the next story because this is about both of them. So there is a video for the new Green Day single, Bang Bang. And it, I can't even say the name of that fucking song. Why would they name a song that?
Well, you heard the original title, right?
Yeah, what was the original? How do you know this? But are you just
gang, what's bang, the original title? Gang Bang.
Oh, okay, that wasn't funny at all.
That's kind of funny.
No. Anyways, though, this Rancid, this Green Day video was directed by Rancid's Tim Armstrong. You go. That was just a beautiful connection. Yeah, he is in it near the end with his big crazy Tim Armstrong beard that he has now. So, anyways, you can go over to Green Day's Facebook page and check out the video. I got some thoughts on this, more than I thought that I would, about a Green Day video. So I don't want to hog the spotlight here. When you guys want it first,
John, you want it?
I'll go first. Okay. First of all, I thought this video, I think the song is okay. I think it's got more oomph than previous Green Day songs. Although what Green Day always does is it kind of picks up. It gets faster, more energetic. It gets faster, more energetic. And then right where it's about to explode, where the circle jerks or somebody would just go crazy, they back off and they go back to the original verse chorus, you know, and they really taper the song off, which that's when you go crazy, not when you go gentle. But I guess they're just trying to make a radio hit. Although the song for Green Day is not terrible. I thought the video started out really cool. I really like the what's that stupid surfer movie where there are Nicks and masks? Event Horizon.
Yes.
Point Break. I like the Point Break homage where they're in the Green Day masks instead of the Nixon masks. I thought that was funny and clever. And I'm like, wow, this video is pretty cool. And then in true classic Tim Armstrong style, like I'm like, this is cool. If you haven't seen the video, it's got three people in Green Day masks, two women, one fellow, and they rob a bank with shotguns, and it's a pretty violent looking scene. You know, they're like, give me the money, and they drive away in a car, and it's almost like a Puff Daddy part where they're just kind of cruising around in the car looking at each other and like nodding at each other. It's a very Puff Daddy type part of a video, and then they're driving up to where Green Day is playing a show. I'm like, oh man, this is going to be crazy. And then what do? They just walk into the park. So I'm like, there's a cool buildup. I'm like, oh man, what's going to happen? And in true Tim Armstrong style, the big result, it's a party where everyone's having fun. And then so the criminals walk into the place, they throw the money in the air, and everybody's dancing and having fun. And I thought it was so anticlimactic. I would have thought it'd be so much cooler if there was sort of an edgier ending. Like, I thought maybe the Green Day masks people were going to go in and shoot Green Day, or maybe like the police would arrest Green Day because they thought they were the people that robbed the bank. You know, I thought there was so much edgy, interesting potential there. But Tim Armstrong's answer was like, nope, it's a big party where everybody's having fun. And I think that very much represents Green Day in the modern era, where they could have an edge, where they could make a statement, where they could do something interesting. They get 4/10 of the way there and then just throw their hands in the air and say, let's have a party and have fun. We're Green Day.
Okay, Mickey. So since they've started putting out new songs, I've just kind of been building this collection of evidence that this band, although the songs haven't been, overall, the songs haven't been offensive, they've been, you know, fine. I think this band is having, like, an identity crisis / midlife crisis. And, I mean, when will Green Day ever play a house show like this? And also, by the way, the house is, like, really nice. If you don't pay attention to them, you look around the background, it's a really nice house. It's not like a little warehouse or like a shack that a DIY band would play.
And everybody's super good looking.
That too. You have a bunch of actresses.
Don't look like a punk show. House punk show. Exactly. I've been into.
And it looks like it smells okay. And I guarantee you, house punk shows smell horrible. But when does Green Day ever play house shows? This doesn't make sense. And I mean, these are arena. This is an arena band. I agree. I think the videos overall is sort of anticlimactic. Someone in the comments said something very astute, and It's the comment was, are we sure this was directed by Tim Armstrong? It appears to be in color. I think to the Tim Time Bomb vision or whatever that they usually do. That failed. But
Ricky, I think you made an incredibly salient point there. I'm going to pick up on it in a sec here. And it's the house show aspect of this that right? gets me. But it gets me for, I think, the opposite reason, because I think that's actually, and this is why I think that, like, it must be incredibly tough to be Green Day at this point, because that feel like seeing them play in a little room with a bunch of people around them, not on a stage, they kind of look like a punk rock band. Like, it kind of looks like that's where they're supposed to be. I mean, as staged and as, you know, nice house and models and all that stuff, but just like take all that out of it. And in my head, my ideal sort of Green Day is the band in that sort of setting. Now, of course, they can't play that sort of setting because they're too big, but I look at them in the video playing in a house on just in the middle of a room. And I'm like, that's the place where the kind of music that this band got famous playing works the best. Like, it doesn't work for me when Green Day is on a giant stage. I keep thinking back to, I don't know if Green Day played that like Woodstock 99. I know the Offspring did, but they're an arena band now, is exactly what you said. But I don't think that arena band fits them. I mean, that's what they are. I don't mean they don't deserve it, I guess, given their level of success. But, like, I don't think it fits.
But they've been doing that for a decade.
Yeah, and I've never thought it fits. Like, I've never felt that's why Green Day on some fundamental level always just seems like a broken concept to me. Because you can take one of these bands out of Gilman and give them lots of money and have them make a huge amount of radio hits, but as soon as you go present them in that context, it just falls apart. Like, you're not Pink Floyd, you're not Aerosmith, you're not Led Zeppelin, you're not the kind of band that either plays with the pomposity or the virtuosity or whatever gives you the right to play those kinds of shows. Like a three chord pop punk band is not that. And that's not to speak ill of the genre. It's just that, like, that's not where that sound to me naturally fits. So you've got Green Day being this massive successful act, and every time I've seen them on stage in that kind of setting, I think like it's either they either look super awkward or they seem sort of unhappy. And you remember a few years ago when Billy Joe was having a little bit of a problem period, and there was that
the iHeart Radio thing.
Yeah, there was something where he sort of freaked out on stage at one of these Californian festivals, right? And I'm thinking that, like, there must be some underlying existential crisis where, like, Green Day can never really go home again.
They
can never go back and be the we're gonna play in a small room that's really sweaty punk rock band. It just doesn't work anymore.
But that's exactly what's happening here. I mean. Which I find incredible.
Well, I know, but I mean, if you ignore the pantomime of it, I look at it and it kind of makes me sad, because I kind of get the appeal of what they're doing in that sort of setting. Like, let's presume it's a real version of that sort of setting. Like, I totally get that, and I could totally be down with it. But I know that, like, you know, you turn this video off, and if I was going to see Green Day these days, it would be them on a big giant stage, and it's just at that point I'm just like, this doesn't work. Like, there's a million other bands that play similar music that I can go see in a tiny shitty room and have that experience, and Green Day, like, you know, God bless them, regardless of the quality of the stuff they're putting out these days, aren't able to deliver that. And it's like a weird paradox that kind of band
claim that they are in some sort of identity crisis right now. I mean,
yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Over verbosely. I'm
yeah. I mean, like here's the thing. Like, yeah, they're playing a house show, and that's it kind of shows that they're trying to go back to the roots a little bit. But it's a glamour show in a house. It's not a punk house show. You know, it's still very Hollywood. This portrayal.
I'm pretty sure there was someone there with an Interrupter shirt on in the video. And I'm like, God bless you, Tim Armstrong, you marketing genius, you.
There was also a shirt of a Time Again or Left Alone, one of his other bands.
Oh, it's probably Left Alone. I know he and that band are fairly close.
How do you know that?
I've seen Elvis Cortez come up on stage with either the Interrupters or... No, with the Interrupters, yeah. And he did, it was when I saw them open for Bad Religion, Elvis Cortez from Left Alone did Sound System with them.
Well, so, there you have it. Boom. Let's play a song, I think. I don't think I've ever played a Harley Flanagan song on the podcast, have I?
I'm sure you have.
Oh, I have?
But I mean,
all right, well, then let's play a Prince Buster song. We're going to talk about Prince Buster later. So we're going to play a Prince Buster song. I don't know what I got to pick which one we're going to play, but this is Prince Buster, who recently passed away. Ska legend. Here's a track by Prince Buster. And we are back, and the big news hits keep rolling along, boys. Keep rolling along. And this is one I think both Ricky and Adam are going to be a big fan of. Against Me, they're streaming their new album. The new album is called Shape Shift With Me. It's out on Large Jane Grace's Total Treble label. I think it's out this Friday, a couple of days. It'll be out by the time you hear this. Adam, Ricky, Adam, what did you guys think of Shape Shift With Me? As the listeners will recall, the lukewarm reception for those first couple of singles, and the question was, does the album redeem itself and put those singles into context?
Yes. I say it does.
Next article.
No. Yeah.
Adam, you go ahead.
I'll go really quick on this because I've only listened to it a few times. And that's, I think it plays way better as a record than as any of the pre-release stuff that I heard from it sounded. And even, I truly think that the songs that they released as the early, I don't mean singles in that there was like a fucking 7-inch you could go buy, but they were like the first ones you could stream, right? The stuff that were the early singles for it, they're album tracks. Like they're totally fine within the context of an album, but they're not some major revelation of a song that's gonna blow people away and make them rethink anything. They're just songs, and they're fine. But and within the record, they're totally fine. Like they fit. The record has flow. It has some levity, which I wasn't really expecting. It feels light and fun, and I'm down with it. I'm down with the sound of the record. I'm cool with that. There's a song called Rebecca that's on the record that I think is incredible. And I don't know. I think I know, but I don't know why that was not the single or is not like the song. And I mean, I don't have to make these business decisions for everyone, but I would have fucking like put out Rebecca and been like, this is a song off our new record. Fuck you. You'll hear from us in 2 months and then done nothing.
Yeah.
Right. Because then if I was Adam and Adam heard Rebecca 2 months ago, I would have been so stoked for this record and just like chomping to the bit to get it. So
that's a hit. See, Adam's like chewing on a big cigar. That's a hit.
Right. So, anyways, so I like that song a lot, like a lot. But I'm fine with this. I think that if any of the songs that they had released earlier, and I can't honestly even remember the names of any of them, did not necessarily grab you, I think that you should go listen to the whole record. And I don't know, if you're anything like me, it'll, in context, is a much better product. So,
okay. So I had planned on not listening to this at all until I got my record in the mail. But since we were doing it today, we were doing this podcast today, I thought I probably should listen to it. I listened to it twice today. The first time through, about more than halfway through, maybe three quarters of the way through, I was prepared to hate this album. I'm not going to lie. And then I got to Rebecca. Actually, I got to Dead Rats. Then I got to Rebecca, and I'm like, okay, let's try this again. I finished it. Then I listened to it again. And I said, okay, I prejudged this way too fast. And I'm digging it. I was hoping still, like we'd been talking about the first singles that they put out, I was hoping for a little bit more power. This is definitely a mellower album, sort of on the searching for a former clarity side ish I'd say. It's an interesting path that they've taken on this one, but overall I give it a thumbs up. But I was a little bit shaky there for a little bit, and I agree, Rebecca is a killer song. Why didn't they just tease us with that? And like, that's it. I don't know why, like 333 or Crash really did not need, could have been like little gems to have found later on when the album came out. But yeah, no, I've enjoyed it. I'm gonna probably listen to it until I get the actual record.
Yeah, I think this band is just terrible at picking singles. Yeah. Like I think they're just really bad.
They made the same bad choices with Transgender Dysphoria Blues too.
You know, I mean, people always say that, you know, it's like a producer, like a punk band should self-produce their records and make all their decisions. But sometimes, you know, an outside view can help a band, you know. like I thought Provision L3 should have been the single because it's so jacked up and
yeah,
so
it's
punk.
A good song.
And I wish they'd done more songs like that. I thought this record was pretty good. I don't have anything else insightful to add than what has already been said because I'm not a huge Against Me fan. I thought this record was pretty good. I just think this band is terrible at picking singles, and I think it just comes down to that they're too close to the source material, so they can't really decide for themselves.
If that's their worst quality, I'm okay with that. That means at least I know now, like, you know what? They're coming up with a new album. Let's prepare to hear the least strongest songs on the album, and then we'll find the real nuggets, the gold nuggets, in the actual album when it comes out.
I've gone back and forth in my head. Is there any strategy to making your weaker songs the singles? And I can't think of one. Like, the only benefit is that, like, people think the album is better than they initially thought. But in that case, you're betting that your album isn't that good. You know what I mean? And I don't think any band would prefer to do that. I just think they're terrible at picking singles. Speaking of new singles that some people think are great and some people think are terrible, Zach De La Rocha, or Zach De La Roca of Rage Against the Machine, who is no longer in Rage Against the Machine, or Rage Against the Machine is on hiatus. He's released his first solo track since the end of Rage Against the Machine. Of course, he was in a group called One Day is a Line, but this is his first true solo track. It was produced by LP of Run the Jewels, which is a fantastic hip-hop group. The new single is called Digging for Windows, produced by LP, and there will be an album that this single is on. Adam White, are you a Rage fan? Are you a Run the Jewels fan? Did you enjoy this single cut?
I feel that me and the rest of the internet are on totally different sides on this song, because I had an opinion about it and I was going to go tweet something really snarky. And then I went and I looked, and like all the Twitter people were saying the exact opposite of what I was thinking. So I like this a lot. I think this is really cool. I think this actually sounds really vital. I think it sounds like it sounds angry and it sounds like there's a purpose to it. It is the polar opposite of what I get out of Prophets of Rage, right? And I went and right before the podcast, I listened to Digging for Windows, and then I went and I listened to the first Prophets of Rage single. And like to me, Zach sounds like an angry, fired up person that is going somewhere with what he's trying to express. The other one sounds more or less like a party band, and like that's fine, but as their mission statement of being this like resurgent, you know, political whatever that they're trying to do, I don't know, I don't think it works with it. And this is why I think that like when you take Zach out of any of the Rage Against the Machine equations, what's left over, you know, despite the instrumental skill of those guys, just does not work for me. So like I liked this a lot. I'm cool with this. I'm down. I like what LP did on the production on it. It's kind of got this like almost like industrial thing happening where it's like it's a little bit crunchy. There's I'm okay with that. I'll go and I look on Twitter, and all the Twitter reaction I see from everyone is just like, whoa, like it's glad this guy isn't in Prophets of Rage. He wouldn't be bringing this shit in there. And I'm like, what? I don't even understand. I don't know. I have a totally different ear for this, I guess, than the people of Twitter. I don't know.
To answer your first question, John, yes, I'm a major Rage Against the Machine fan. I have been for a long time. I saw them at their very last show in 2011. Their last show as of now. When I first saw this, I'm like, oh, well, at least Zach's doing something, because for a long time we were not hearing anything. And I just thought like Prophets of Rage happened because they wanted to get Rage Against the Machine back together, but he's just being difficult. It turns out he's doing his own thing. I can respect that. When I listen to this, I can say that I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would. I don't like it. But I do agree with Adam. I mean, at least you get that Zach is fantastic at bringing that urgency that is needed for Rage or Prophets of Rage or whatever the fuck. And he does that here, and I get that. I won't be listening to the rest of this album though.
I used to be an LP hater. Now I'm a pretty big LP fan. I'm a huge Run the Jewels fan. I think LP is one of the few hip-hop producers out there that really still does make menacing, hard beats. I think maybe LP tried to do a little bit too much of what's that terrible hip-hop group that everyone says they like but no one actually likes? Death Camps. Is that what the band's called? Death Camps? Death Grips. Death Grips. And I think because like Death Grips thing is like the music is always abrasive all the time. I like the underlying beat here. I didn't really like the abrasive buzzing going through it. However, they're taking risks. I mean, I'm a huge Chuck D fan, but Prophets of Rage is not taking risks, and it just seems to be a little boring. Where this is dangerous, I don't quite like everything about it, but there's something interesting going on, and Zach is bringing his A game vocally. I will definitely be excited to check this out in the future. And if there's one guy that can, you know, make a Zach album that's parallel to a Rage album, it's LP, who is a great producer and is doing great stuff right now.
Yeah, I don't want to let on that like this is the greatest thing ever or anything like that. It's certainly not the normal kind of stuff that I would listen to. But just like I can't help but approach this with my Prophets of Rage cynicism hat on, and it just makes my opinion of that other band go down.
Well, you know what? You know what? This really does show that Zach is trying to make new interesting stuff instead of resting on his laurels, which you can't quite say for Prophets of Rage.
Yeah, that's what I was saying too. I mean, I thought he just didn't want to do music anymore, which would be a shame because he's clearly talented.
I think he's difficult to work with, and I think he's a little nutso. That's my guess. And then I think he's like hyper, like I think he fidgets with everything till it's ruined. You know, most times things aren't perfect. You just got to get them as close to perfect as you can realistically and just let them breathe. You know, I think he wants every little thing. Like, I think he puts a great amount of weight and effort and not pomposity. I think he feels as though he can't make a misstep, even though one day is a line and actually wasn't that great. I think he puts a great deal of pressure upon himself, and the result is you can overwork something and it's not as good as it should have
been.
Yeah,
you can tell, like, there's a lot, you could tell that when they were working on the Rage Against Machine albums, you could tell there's probably a lot of meticulousness going on.
Oh, see, I think those albums actually feel kind of loose.
Well, I would say the first one, yes. Well, I can only comment. The two other studio ones, I'd say no. I think that you could tell like there's a bit more. You could tell he took a bit more time with those two.
Well, there's four studio albums.
Oh yeah, that's
there's right. The first one. There's Evil Empire. Then there's Covers. Then there's Battle of Los Angeles.
I forgot the Covers.
I'm only actually familiar with the first two albums.
Oh, Battle of Los Angeles is fantastic.
Well, I will check it out on Ricky's
it's great.
Suggestion. Let's do our last story here. Prince Buster has passed away. Prince Buster was a ska, rocksteady, and reggae star in Jamaica. His biggest hits were in the 60s, but he was doing stuff up until the 90s. He did kind of Scatolites kind of music, but Prince Buster's lyrics kind of had a little bit more edge to it, definitely a lot more politics to it. And, you know, he was 79. That's not super old, but, you know, at least he's not like 30. Legendary musician, and I don't know what else you can say. Adam White, any commentary on Prince Buster?
No, I mean, it feels like there's been a few people from...
Well, they're getting old, you know?
They're all from that same cohort, but this is like the third or fourth, you know, death of... I mean, not just like people that were like associated with the Scatolites at some point, but like just like people from that era of Jamaican ska that we've lost this year. Yeah, I don't have much to say. Go listen to Al Capone or something.
Early proponent of running one's own label, Prince Buster.
Yeah, I don't have much to say either. What can I say? I mean, 2016 has been a hard year on music in terms of this situation.
Honestly, it's just going to get worse because, you know, from our perspective, popular music started in the 60s, even though it didn't really. That's how we view it, people of our generation and younger. And those guys are getting old, and that's just how it's going to be. You know, I mean, it's not going to get less. It's going to get more, you know. I mean, think about it. Paul Simonon is what? Well, he's probably about 60, you know, isn't he?
Don't jinx Paul Simonon.
I take it back. Paul Simonon is 22. But you know what I'm saying is the punkers from 77, 76, they're not spring chickens anymore.
Yeah.
This is going to accelerate. It's just going to be you know, we should just dedicate a whole section of the website to the daily.
Like I said before, I'll say it again. See him while you can. If you have the chance to see a legendary musician, go see him. You don't know when you're going to have the chance to see him again. And also, let musicians know how much you appreciate them while they're still alive. It doesn't do them too much good to do a big tribute to them after they pass away. You know, go see them live. Tell them how great they are when they're still doing their thing.
All right. Well, we already played a Prince Buster song earlier, so I guess we have to end with a jump into another whole thing. So, Ricky, play a song.
So, a friend of mine showed me this band called Avenues. They're out of Milwaukee, and they put out a really fun 10-inch last year on Wiretap Records. It's like a seven. A 6 or 7 track EP that's really good. That's pretty good. Pop punk. I know I've been doing a lot of hardcore in the last few episodes. But this song is called Out of Sight by the Avenues off their Creeper EP. Here it is.
That was The Avenues, and this was Punk News Podcast 316. Adam White, thanks for giving us your wisdom, as always, with regards to Against Me, and specifically with regards to your deep thoughts on Gloss and how one can exist outside the major label system.
I try.
And Tricky Ricky, thank you for your insight on Zach De La Roca and basically Green Day and how they cannot pay house parties anymore, no matter how much they want to.
You know what? I'm happy to fire missiles at someone's good time when I see it bullshitting other people.
And thanks to podcast producer Greg Simpson. This is features editor John Gentile. Reach us at podcast@punknews.org, and we'll see you next week.